First of all, let me thank everybody for coming out on a snowy night with very late last-minute notice. And I want to give a special thanks to Mordechai Becher for agreeing to share with us this shiur and talk this evening. I'll share with you momentarily an introduction to Becher, but I will tell you that the last-minute notice that you will receive was not more than several hours later than the last-minute notice Rabbi Becher received. It was just a conversation that came out of the fact that he was coming into town. I did not know that he was coming into town, and when I heard that that was taking place, it was an opportunity. I've known Rabbi Becher for many, many years. The connection goes back to Australia, and of course my connection to Australia is well known. And Rabbi Becher hails from Australia. Many of you know Rabbi Becher longer than I do, so. But he is a well-renowned lecturer for the Gateways program. He has published books. He has lectured for the Federation. He worked for Or Sameach as a lecturer for many, many years. A sought-after speaker, erudite, and dynamic speaker on a myriad of topics, from the topic we'll hear from this evening to the creativity and the breadth of the list of topics that Rabbi Becher sent me was really remarkable. So it's my honor to have Rabbi Becher here in the shul and thank him again profusely for agreeing to come and share with us this presentation.
Thank you.
If you could put your phones on silent or vibrate out of sensitivity to those who are going to sleep. I came to visit a close friend of mine. Been here a few times to visit him, Rav Gershon Zeffron. This was going to be Schus of Rafua Shlema, so now it's Leilui Nishmas, Rav Gershon. And it should be a schus for his neshama. Anyway, that's why I came to St. Louis. Okay, so I want to read you a list of people, and we'll see what they have in common. Rav Yitzhak Huttner, who is the Rosh Hashiva of Chaim Berlin. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Torah Das. Rav Avram Eliyahu Kaplan, the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. Rav Aaron Kotler, Beis Medrash Gavah of Lakewood. Rav David Leibovitz, Yeshivas Chafetz Chaim in New York. Rav Yaakov Yitzhak Rudeman, Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Israel in Baltimore. Rav Yecheskel Sarna, the Chevron Yeshiva in Jerusalem. Rav Isaac Shur Slobodka in Bnei Barak. Rav Shach, Rosh Yeshiva of Ponovich. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg of Berlin University and Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. What did they have in common? Anyone? Sorry? Aside from obvious things, like they were all Jewish male and rabbis, but that's right. Right, 10 points for Gryffindor. They were all students of Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, the Altar of Slobodka. The Altar of Slobodka, 1849 to 1927, was, I would say, without exaggeration, probably the most influential person in Lithuania in Torah Jewry. I mean, if you look at the range of people who were students of his and the impact that they had on the Jewish world, just think Ner Israel, Chafetz Chaim, Lakewood, Hildesheimer, Rabbinical Seminary, etc. It's mind-boggling. And he was able to produce these people. And it's interesting, as a young man, he came to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was a very quick judge of character, a very quick judge of abilities. He could look at a person, size them up very, very quickly. And as a young man, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel came to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and he said, "What is my job in life? What do you think I should be doing in life?" So, as you think, hedge fund, social networking, whatever. You know, I don't know what he was thinking. But he asked him, what should he be doing in life? So Rav Yisrael Salanter quoted a pasuk in Tehillim. He quoted a pasuk in Yeshaya. It says the following. It says, Koyama Ram Venissa, Shoichenad Vekadosh, Shmo Amaram Vekadosh. So says God, who is exalted and holy, the one who dwells upon high. He says, Ves Daka Ushval Ruach, and nevertheless he dwells with those who are downtrodden and lowly of spirit. Lahachyois Ruach Shvalin, Ulahachyois Lev Nikoim. To revive the heart of the downtrodden and to revive the heart of those who are lowly. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter saw in this Rav Nosson Tzvi, he saw in him the ability to raise and elevate people to a level that they could not have done by themselves. And he says, that's your job in life. And he took it very seriously. And, you know, I study every week with an elderly man who was left Vilna when he was 17. Left Vilna when he was 17. He remembers the funeral of Chaim Oizer Grzynski. And I asked him, who was looked down upon in Vilna? You know, who was the most, who did everyone look down upon? Anyone have any idea? Who were like the lowest class of society in Vilna? You know, it was shocking. He says the yeshiva students. Yeshiva students. The guys that were looked at as nebuch, as pathetic, as losers, except whatever that is in Yiddish. But that's how they were looked down upon. And Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, Rav Yisrael Salanter, gave the task to Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. He gave him the task to lahachyos ruach shvalim ulahachyos lev nikan, to raise and to elevate. And his educational view, his educational outlook, was actually amazing and radical and something which I think we can learn from. And he saw it throughout Chazal and the Rishonim. He saw his educational view. He saw in many, many diverse, different places throughout the writings of our sages, some of which I gave you in the sources that you were learning just now. And basically, he was of the opinion that the most important component in a person's morality, the most important component in a person being able to achieve their potential, was a feeling of kavod, a feeling of honor, a feeling of dignity, a feeling of self-esteem, honor, and dignity. He said that is, for him, the center of what the purpose of education is. And it's amazing. We don't think of it that way. I don't think we do anyway. You ask most teachers, you ask most educators, what is the primary purpose of education? Do you think they'll say to give the student a sense of honor? I don't think, right? I mean, I think most of them will say to keep the kids quiet for about an hour and then I can get out of there, right? Or to have them pass the regents or whatever the equivalent is, right? Or to feed information which they spew back to me at the exam, etc. That's it. But the idea, that's his primary goal. And you see, I mean, I think he was successful. I don't think it could be. I mean, I think he was very successful in terms of his students. So to see a number of the places where he saw this, first of all, I quoted the Sefer Achinuch. Sefer Achinuch, there's a mitzvah, prohibition. We call it, euphemistically, Birchat Hashem, blessing God. Obviously, there's no prohibition against blessing God. What it actually refers to is the prohibition against cursing God. Klala, cursing. So you'd expect that here is the Sefer Achinuch is giving me the rationale, the reasoning behind the prohibition against cursing God. Birchat Hashem. So what would you expect him to be focused on? The lack of respect for God, the lack of appropriate relationship with the Creator, the antithesis of what you're supposed to. That's not what he talks about. Listen to what he talks about. He says the following. He says, Mishorshei HaMitzvah, Bebirkas Hashem, the root of this commandment against the cursing of God, he says is this. Lefi shenitroken ha'adam b'ma'amar ha'ra ha'hu mikol tova. Because the person is emptied of all good when he speaks in that way. V'chol hod nafsho nefach alav l'mashchit. The glory of his soul becomes corrupted. V'yenehu nechshav ki behemot. He's considered like an animal. Because in that very area, in that very area, that God elevated or made the human different from the animals for positive purposes, he has taken that very, i.e. the power of speech the ability to put my thoughts into speech. He's taken that power of speech and he's degraded it. He says, Motzil tola gamre mikolaret get negada nasika sheretz nimas. He becomes like lowly worm, venelach lumatim emeno, even below that. He says, that's why the Torah says not to do this. Amazing. Not one word about the prohibition of cursing God in terms of a relationship with God. He's not talking about what you're not really doing anything to God, but he talks about it only in terms of one thing, which is, what have you done to yourself? You have degraded your power of speech. You have taken the area that makes us superior to everything else in the physical world, everything else in the world, and you have taken that and we have used it in a negative way. Hod nafshol nashkit, you have turned the glory of our soul into something corrupt and negative. So that's fascinating. He's looking at it totally in terms, and I guess, you know, the truth is, I had seen this Sefer HaChinuch, but when I heard how Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel looked at it, it's something totally different. Sometimes you can look at something 100 times, and until you actually hear someone's insight into it, you never actually understand it. And the same is true here. I read that, and it didn't strike me, but what struck the Altar of Slobodka, they called him the Altar of Slobodka even when he was a young man. He was the Elder of Slobodka, right? He saw that and he says, why? The Sefer HaChinuch is totally focused on the wrong area. He's not focused. He doesn't seem to be focused on God. Doesn't seem to be focused on my relationship with God. He doesn't seem to be focused on my lack of respect for God. What's he focused on? My lack of self-respect. That's what he's focused on. That's what the Sefer HaChinuch is focused on. The next one. We have a prohibition against breaking bones in the Pesach, in the Korban Pesach, the Passover offering. Not allowed to break bones in the Pesach, Korban Pesach. We all know that the basic idea of the Korban Pesach was that there's a few ideas, but the basic idea is that one of the Egyptians venerated the ram god Khnum. The ram god Khnum had the head of a ram, body of a human being. He was the lord of the first cataract waterfall of the Nile River. They had a veneration for him. They believed his spirit was incarnate in the ram, in sheep, etc. And so when the Jews were in Egypt, we were slaves, but we were not only physically enslaved, we were psychologically enslaved. There's such a thing as a slave mentality, where you could have one overseer controlling 100 able-bodied people, but they have a slave mentality, so they're scared. They won't do anything. They won't rebel, etc. So the Jews had to break out of that. In addition, we were also enslaved by Egyptian culture. Jews were into the Egyptian. There were many Egyptian superstitions. We probably believed in a lot of their ideals, etc. As the Talmud says, many Jews were idolaters at that time. So Hashem wanted us to break out of this slave mentality and to break away from Egyptian ideology. What better way to do that than to take something which the Egyptians venerated as a god, a sheep, to slaughter it publicly, and then the Torah says, thou shalt not boil it. You've got to put it on a spit and have a barbecue. You've got to roast it whole on a spit. Why are you not allowed to boil it? Why do you have to roast it whole? The answer is very simple. We want the Egyptians, two Egyptians walking by, you know, Akhenaten, Imenhotep, they're walking around. That's how Egyptians walk, right? So basically, you ever seen Egyptian pictures? I mean, right? Say, family photo. So there's two Egyptians, they're walking along, right? And one of them says, dude, what's that smell? He's like, no, it's coming from the Goldbergs. So they walk over to the Goldberg fence. They look over the fence. And there, on the spit, he says, oh my God. Right there on the barbecue. Right there on the barbecue. So they say to the Jew, what are you doing? Now, so for the Jews to do this took incredible courage. I mean, you could imagine the courage. To put this into American terminology so it's crystal clear to you. Right, this would be the equivalent of walking into the hood, going over to the man in front of his peeps, ripping off his bling, and carving your initials in front of his Escalade. Okay? This is what we call suicide, right? But to actually do this would be impossible. I'm sure you're familiar. This is American street language. This would be colloquial. I'm sure you all speak like that, Norman. Right, okay. That's what the Jews were doing. So all the various halachot, when you understand that, many of the laws of the Passover offering make total sense. The fact that it has to be whole, has to be recognizable, the fact that it has to be on a spit, don't boil it, because if you boil it, you can't really smell. The fact that even the Zohar even says, right, that the fact that you eat it for dessert after the meal is to further diss the Egyptians, to get in their face. Because the Egyptians will say, well, Nebuchadnezzar, they're slaves, they must be starving. Jews say, actually, no, I'm quite full, this is just dessert. Right, so even more offensive. Right, but the idea of breaking, why can't you break the bones? Why can't you break the bones? So the Sefer HaChinuch gives a reason which is quite interesting. He says the following. He says, Gamzeh she'en kavod libnei malachim v'yotze eretz legarer ha'atzamot o l'shabram kekalavim. It is not dignified for princes, for royalty, for rulers of the land to be breaking open bones and sucking out the marrow. And to be, it's beneath the dignity. The Jews are coming out of Egypt. We are becoming nobility. God's making us into princes. He's making us into royalty, nobility. So for nobility, I can't imagine, Queen Elizabeth sitting there with Prince Philip. Oi, Phil, any marrow in the bone there, mate? You want to pass it over? Right? I don't think so. This does not happen. Right? They're not sitting there at the state meal. Oh, that's delicious. Right? It's unbelievable. Right. So they don't do that. There's a certain level of dignity that has to be maintained. And the Sefer HaChinuch says the prohibition against Shviras Etzem, breaking bones, in the Passover offering is based on this idea. That is to say, that to maintain this level of kavod, and he goes on to say, Lo ye'ut la'sokach. He says it's only appropriate to do this for poverty-stricken people who are starving. He says, no, not for us. We're becoming mamlechet kohanim. We're becoming a nation of priests. We're becoming the treasured, chosen people. He says, therefore, we have to act in a dignified, noble, and royal manner. It is interesting there was a story which is quoted by John Cooper, who wrote a book at Oxford University. He wrote a book called Eat and Be Satisfied, It's a History of Jewish Gastronomy. Fascinating book. And he coins the phrase that the Jews are a gastrocentric people. That's how he puts it at the very beginning. But he actually cites a biography of a captain of an American ship during the Barbary Pirate Wars, when the United States sent Navy and Marines to the Mediterranean to fight Islamic pirates. And apparently one of the ships sunk, I think it was called Commerce, and the captain was washed ashore. And he's lying on the beach, he's dehydrated, he's delirious, he's like, and a Jewish family takes him into their home. I think it was Morocco. They bring him into their home, and he's like not totally conscious. And they have him upstairs. He regains consciousness Friday night. So he comes out. First of all, he writes how the smell was. There was an amazing, beautiful smell, French Moroccan cuisine. Couldn't get right. He smells this. Oh, and he comes downstairs and he sees this family sitting around the table. There's a whole large group around the table wearing beautiful kaftans with fine silverware at the table, candles, drinking fine wine, eating good food. He says they're all sitting around. He says they had little books and they were singing and they were talking. Even the children could read. He was amazed by this. I think he was from New Jersey. So he sees this and he's amazed. He sees all this stuff. And he says, and he writes, his first thought was that he had been saved by the nobility of Morocco. He thought this must be one of the royal families of Morocco must have saved him. Turns out, he finds out, no, it's not the royal family, it's just Jews and it's their Sunday. He keeps calling it their Sunday, meaning Shabbos, right? But that's an amazing, so there's a transformation. We become nobility. And that's what he's saying here at the Passover, at Pesach, Korban Pesach, it's done in such a way that we are nobility. And in addition, the Sefer HaChinuch talks about also the prohibition against creepy crawlies, the bugs and insects and Cajun cuisine, etc. So he says the prohibition here is based on this idea as well, that we should not degrade and debase ourselves. We have to cultivate a certain aesthetic sensitivity, a sense of kavod. And one of the most amazing sources is you're probably wondering, what is this thing in Sanhedrin? I don't know if I quoted that there, Sanhedrin. You had that? So Sanhedrin, with the Mishnah in Sanhedrin says that when witnesses come to court, we have to give them very stern warning about perjury. The judges, I think they do this in secular courts, but the judge gives a stern warning to the witnesses. This, if you perjure yourself, if you lie, this will happen, this will happen, this will happen, etc., etc. So the Gemara goes through a number of things which the judge says, and the halacha is that they say all of these things. And it goes through, it says, if you lie, you will bring, we tell them they will bring kafna, they will bring famine to the land of Israel. So the judge says, you guys, you'll be responsible if a famine comes to Israel, it's your responsibility. You will be responsible for causing starvation in the land of Israel. Chas v'shalom. And then he says, what else do we tell them? We tell them they will be responsible for war. If it is because of lies and perjuring witnesses that the sword comes to the land. So we say, you will be responsible for famine, starvation amongst the Jewish people, the sword, horrific wars, and in addition, also for disease, sicknesses, terrible sicknesses and illnesses. So we tell them horrific stuff that for which they are responsible if they lie. What is the last thing? What did we tell them in the very end? Amazing. We say, Amrinan luhu, sahade shakre aogrehu zile. False witnesses are not even respected by the people who hire them. The clincher. You know, the final... Right? Yes, you're responsible for famine, you're responsible for war, you're responsible for disease. Oh, and one more thing. The guys who hired you to lie, even they don't respect you. That's supposed to be the clincher. Why is that the clincher? So the Alter of Slobodka said, because you know why? He says, if the person, if their kavod is taken away from them completely, they will either die or go insane. If a person doesn't have a shred of honor left, not one shred of honor. If you would imagine, I heard this from my teacher, Rav Moshe Shapiro, who's a student of Rav Chizkel Sarna and various other of the Zakenim. His Zakenim, his elders, were people who learned in Slobodka. And Rav Sarna told him, he says, he heard from Rav Alter of Slobodka, he says, is if you could somehow extract all of someone's kavod from them, not 1 ounce remains, that either go insane or die. And the last thing that we tell these witnesses is, we tell them, don't think that you have any respect from anyone, because even the guys who hired you don't respect you. And why is this so? So it's interesting, the Raza, Reb Zrachya Halevi, the Bala Maor, in his commentary on the Rif, he starts it with a beautiful introduction. And in the introduction, he starts it by saying, "Hanefesh baharbe mekoymos batoira." In many places in our Torah, "Hanefesh nikreis kavod." The soul, one of the names for the soul is kavod. "Ura kavodi aira shacha." What does that verse mean? "Ura kavodi." How would anyone read that? When you translate that, what does it mean? "Ura kavodi, awake my honor." Aira shacha, I'll get up for the morning. What do you mean, awake my honor? What does that even mean? So he understands that as meaning, awake my soul. And other verses that he brings, smach libi v'yagel kavodi, let my heart be happy, and my kavodi, my honor, rejoice. It's like an interesting thing. So leman yizamercha chavod v'lo yidom, in order that my soul sing to you. So actually, the kavod is a synonym, or a nickname for the soul. Rabbeinu Bachai says this as well. He says that the human soul, one of the names for our soul is kavod. Why is it so? Because inasmuch as we are created in the image of God, so the ultimate source of all kavod, of all honor, of all dignity, is God himself. There is no greater dignity, honor, than God himself. If we are created in the image of God, that means we have within us a certain level of this divine dignity. And it's expressed in many different ways. The human being, for example, you know, at least it used to be so, that people would feel embarrassed if they'd have to receive a handout. Right? The Gemara says, "Pshot nevelsa b'shuk." Right? You should better to actually skin carcasses in the marketplace preferable than taking charity. Right, skinning a carcass in the marketplace probably was one of the worst jobs you could possibly imagine. Right, they're the freshly killed animal and you are flaying the skin off it. Right, I mean, you can imagine walking into the pub, you know, after a day at work, you're covered in blood. I mean, they're not going to let you in. You can't get, you wouldn't be served a beer. Right, so what could be worse? So basically, right, you have this, but it's better to do that. And you know, the Chazal tell us in Pirkei Avos, Ehov es hamalocha, love work, love work. Hamalocha mechabedes es ba'aleha. And we find this idea of the dignity of work, the idea, because this is also based on the fact that we are similar to God. Why? Because inasmuch as God is the only being who is completely and utterly independent, everyone else, everything else is dependent. Everyone else and everything, nothing, as Rambam says, Maimonides points out, nothing, if you could imagine, right, that if you could imagine it is possible, you could imagine that nothing would exist except for God. But it's impossible to imagine that anything exists and not God. He says everything is dependent upon God for its existence, which means God is the only truly independent being. But if we are created in the image of God, that means we have a desire to be independent. This, of course, is the famous idea mentioned by the Beis Yosef in Magid Meshorim, where he talks about Nahama de Kisufa, bread of shame. Just the following example, like, you know, we all know it's a very famous question which Rabbi Yosef Kara asked and the Ramchal discusses in Derech Hashem and Das Tfunas. But the question is the following. You know, let's say look, my birthday's coming up. It's not really, but you can, you know, feel free to give me presents. But anyway, let's say, you know, it's my birthday next week. So you come over to me, you say, "Here, Mordechai, I bought you a present." I say, "Oh, thank you. That's very unusual of you." And you give me this small, beautifully wrapped box. And I say, "Oh, wonder what this is. Earrings, or who knows, nose stud, I don't know." So you open it up, and in it is a key. I say, "Oh, that's nice, you gave me a key for my birthday." He says, no, it's a key to a safety deposit box. I say, "Oh." Right, now my thank you is a little more sincere. Right, I say, "Well, that's great. Where is the bank?" He says, "In Grozny. I say, "Grozny, is that not in Chechnya?" "Yeah. It's in Chechnya." I said, "How do you get there?" He says, "Well, you get a commercial flight to Moscow, and then from Sheremetyevo Airport, you just get Air Chechnya to Grodny Airport." I said, "Air Chechnya is one of those, you know, one of those flights where you kiss the ground no matter where you land. You know, people used to kiss the ground in Eretz Yisrael. There are certain airlines, you land in Newark, you kiss the ground, you know, radon gas and all, right?" So Air Chechnya. He says, "Now, however, the airport's about 30 kilometers from the bank." I say, "Okay, that's not a long trip. 30 kilometers, not a big deal." He says, "Yeah, the first 10 kilometers is infested with Islamic fundamentalist terrorists." I say, "Ah." He says, "If you make it through the first 10 kilometers, the next 10K is patrolled by Russian Spetsnaz. Those are elite Russian commandos who are highly trained killers and have not been paid for 3 years. So you make it through the Islamic, you know, whack jobs, and then you get through the Russian killers." And I say, "And the next 10 kilometers, he says, "the Russian mafia is in control of that." He says, "If you make it to the bank, just remember to turn it clockwise, otherwise a little booby trap will blow up the safety deposit box. Happy birthday." What would you say to someone like that? I would say, "Next time, just send me an e-card, Kermit the Frog singing happy birthday, crashing my hard drive, whatever it is, right? Just do that. I you know, I'm really, a card would be fine. I do not need a present." You know, but what are you kidding me? If you want to give me a present, you're going to make me schlep to Chechnya, fight my way through Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, fight my way through Russian Spetsnaz commandos, fight my way through the Russian mafia, deal with a booby trap safety deposit box, and then get your present. I mean, what? So why does God make us do this? We go through a life and a world and the struggle, and it's difficult. And yes, you'll tell me Adam didn't have all that, but Adam did have a struggle. Because if you think all of the struggles of all of humanity, all focused into one thing, was that test of the tree. They failed. Okay. But either way, there's a struggle. So why does, if God wants to give me himself, he wants to give me a relationship with himself, why do we have to go through this terrible struggle? And the answer, given in two words, By the in Kabbalistic sources, the answer is Nahama de Kisufa. That means bread of shame. What does it mean, bread of shame? if I receive something without having earned it, if I get something without having worked for it, if I enjoy something without it really being mine, there's a flaw, there's a problem. It's not complete. It's incomplete. Now, you could ask at that point, as the Ramchal in fact asks, you could now ask, well, hello, don't create the capacity to feel shame, and then it won't be a problem. Then you won't have to create the world. Then you'll be able to give us the good without us working for it, right? Who created shame? Who created the capacity to feel that way? God. Don't create that, then you won't have to worry. Is the question clear? Everyone, people following? Okay, great. Okay. So the Ramchal answers, he says, well, we have to understand, because you see, the feeling of shame in receiving without giving, in getting without earning, he says, is not just some random arbitrary factor that God threw into the mix. He says the reason we feel that is because we're created similar to God. So in the same way that God is utterly, completely independent and a total giver and doesn't receive or take anything, so if the human being is created similar to God, we also have to be in the same way. We've got to be independent. We have to be givers, not takers. We have that same feeling. It's built in to the very essence of the human being because we are in the image of God. In order to have the relationship with God, we have to be similar, compatible to God. So we have to actually encourage that trait of dignity, of honor, of giving, not taking, of earning our keep as opposed to just getting it, right? We have to encourage that trait. That's an important trait because that's central to our similarity to God. Is this clear so far? And obviously, you cannot really have the relationship with God without the similarity, the compatibility. I always use the example that I remember a number of many years ago in the 1900s. So the Coca-Cola had a competition. You open the Coke bottle, you look inside. I'm sure you're familiar with it. You look inside and it says, you've won. Or it says, try again. Yeah, try again. I actually had a guy at my house for Shabbos once. He opens a Coke bottle. He looks at it and says, try again. So he closes it and he opens it and closes it and he opens it. He's like, dude, this is not working. Anyway, so the kids say, Abba, make him stop. Anyway, so now the first prize in the competition was you get to spend a week with the Beastie Boys. That's a musical group for those who are not, you know, familiar with them. Anyway, so you get to spend a week with the Beastie Boys. I guess second prize is 2 weeks. But anyway, so you spend a week with the Beastie Boys. So I imagine to myself the following scenario. You know, Herbert von Karajan, you ever heard of Herbert von Karajan? He's the great famous German conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. So Herbert von Karajan is you know, conducting a series of concerts in New York. He opens a Coke, goose steps over to the Coke machine after the concert and he gets a Coke. He opens it up, it says, you have won. So he looks at the side and it says, Van Vick mit der Beastie Boy Chicks. Let me ask you something. Herbert von Karajan, conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic, chilling with the Beastie Boys for a week. Is this first prize or condemnation to the depths of Gehinnom for both parties? The answer is B, right? Because there's no compatibility, there's no similarity. You've got to have the similarity, the compatibility in order to have that relationship, that pleasure, the joy, the closeness, and the unity and the dvekas with our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so therefore, Rav Finkel says, that's one of the reasons, that's maybe the main reason that the idea of kovod is so important. Because that concept, that's central to who we are, that's central to our similarity to God, that's central to our creation, and that's central to what we're about. And he says, and that is also, should be, ideally, the reason we avoid doing the wrong thing. He quotes the Medrash. Medrash says, it says on a Pasuk in Tehillim, it says, L'David maskil ashrei nesui pesha kisui chata'a. So normally we translate that as, happy is he who is free of sin and covers over his iniquities. But the Medrash understands, nasui actually means elevated. So the Medrash puts it this way, Ashrav la'adam, shehu gavoa mipisho, velo pisho gavoa mimena. Happy is the person who he is above his sin is not above him. So the Alter understood it in the following way. He says, the person, he used to say this, I don't tell my students to avoid averus, to avoid sin, because it's prohibited. I don't tell my students to avoid sin because they'll get punished. I don't tell my students to avoid sin because the Torah says not to. I tell my students to avoid sin because it's beneath their dignity. It's not mechubad. It's beneath your dignity. He understood that telling someone don't because it's osur, don't because you get punished, don't because you're burned forever, etc. He says that is not effective. That squashes, that suppresses, that's not what it's about. He says rather he would tell his students, he says, don't do that. It's beneath your dignity. In Yiddish we'd say it pasnished. It's pasnished, beneath you. The Kotzker Rebbe said a similar thing. In a different way, the Kotzker Rebbe said, he would tell his students, he says, what? He says, the reason I don't do Averis is because who's got time? I've got much more important things to do with my life. Ridiculous. Spend my time on that. That's how Kotzker put it. But this is how the Rav Nosson Tzvi understood it in that way. And Rav Moshe Shapiro says, that's what we need to tell our students, ourselves, and our children. That the reason I'm not, it's because beneath me. This is not, I'm way beyond that. It's interesting. He quoted, you know, the very beautiful pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, that it talks about Sugaba Shoshanim, a hedge of roses. Rabbi Lamb's famous book, A Hedge of Roses, is based on this midrash, or the title, at least, is based on the midrash. The midrash tells us, it talks about what's to stop people in private from not doing a sin. As the way it puts it is, it says, Eza Kotel Barzel Yesh Beneim, right? Man and a woman, there's a prohibition of Nida, right? What wall of metal is there between them? Right? Eza Amud Barzel, what pillar of iron? Eza Nachash Nashko, what snake has bitten you? Eza Akrav, which scorpion is there? He says, there's nothing there except for the words of the Torah, which is the beautiful hedge of roses. He says, a person is about to eat something. Someone says, don't! There's chelev in that. Forbidden fat. He says, what police force? What iron barrier? What's stopping you? There's nothing stopping you except for the hedge of roses of the Torah. Now, the way a lot of people understand that phrase, the hedge of roses, is the idea that when you see a hedge of roses, would you run through a hedge of roses? Would anyone run through a hedge of roses? No. Why not? That's right. Because although it looks very beautiful, but what's inside a hedge of roses? Lots and lots of thorns. You'll be lacerated, and it'll be very painful. So the Alter Sabaka said, if that's the meaning of the hedge of roses, then it's not the roses that are doing anything, it's the thorns. So what the pasuk should say is, suga ba chochim, a fence of thorns. It should not say a fence of roses, because the roses are not doing a darn thing. The roses are camouflaging the true fence, which are the thorns. He says, no, that's not what it means. You know why you do not go through a hedge of roses? Because they are too beautiful to trample them. That's why we don't go through it. Not forget the thorns. If they'd have no thorn, if it be a hedge of chrysanthemums, right? So I wouldn't go through that either. Not because there's thorns, because they don't have thorns. Why? Because it's so beautiful. And only a boor, only an ignoramus, only a crude, primitive, ignorant person would be willing to trample on something of such beauty. For me, it is beneath my dignity to destroy something of such beauty. That, Rav Finkel said, that's the meaning of Sugaba Shoshanim. It's not the thorns, it's not the prohibition, it's the sense of the feeling that it's beneath my dignity to trample on something which is so beautiful. We're in the Parshas of Shmois. The Meshech Chochma points out in Perek Vav of Shmois. He talks of one of the most beautiful pieces in the Meshech Chochma, and just really beautiful. It's in Perek Vav, Posuk Vav, well worth looking at. At first, fantastic stuff for the Seder. He talks about the four cups of wine and the four languages of redemption. So one of the languages of redemption, it says Ga'alti. Ga'alti. God says, I've redeemed you. So the Meshech Chochma says, you know, he says, what does that mean? He says, because the Eved Ruchoi Shfola. A slave is a very low spirit. He says when God redeemed the Jewish people, what that meant was he raised us and he gave us a hope for the future. He gave us an understanding that we were not slaves. We were not slaves. We had a future. He says that's expressed in two ways. We didn't change our names and we had the Hebrew language. Not changing our names meant that we were attached to our past. We understood, you know, we understood that that's not who I am. Interesting. In Brooklyn, in the Brooklyn Museum, there's a papyrus. It's a very famous papyrus. And it's a papyrus which has the possessions of an Egyptian household. Two of the possessions in this Egyptian household are slaves. One slave is Shifra and one is Asher. So Jewish names, Shifra and Asher. Not, I don't know if these are the Shifra and the Asher. I'm certainly not, because it doesn't fit out historically. But it's from the period of the slavery. And it talks about, but it's got, it says Shifra and it gives her an Egyptian name. Shifra, who's called, and it gives the Egyptian name. And then Asher, and it gives an Egyptian name. The Jews, we are told, fought and did not want to give up their names. Why? So you know what? Anyone ever seen the there was a series. It's actually a book, but it was a series. I didn't read the book, but I saw the series on television a long time ago. Right? It's called Roots. Anyone see that? Yeah, Roots. Right. Some of the older people. Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. The kids here have no idea what I'm talking about. I think I'm talking about an athletic gear. Right. So Roots. Anyway. So it was about. So this black slave, he's taken from Africa, he's brought to the United States by you lot, and he is terrible. And what happens is the owner says his name is Kunta Kinte, and his owner says your name's Toby, and he refuses to take the name Toby, and the owner beats him to an inch of his life, and he still refuses to take the name. And you understand why? It's clear why. Why is he doing that? Because if he accepts the name that the owner gives him, what's he saying? That's who I am. I'm a slave. That's my existence. That's my reality. That's who I am. The Jewish people, in the same way that Kunta Kinte didn't want to do it, the Jews in Egypt did not want to do it. Right? They did not want to give up their names because that was part of the dignity of knowing where I'm from. I am not a slave. And, the Meshech Chochma says, they kept the Hebrew language, because a nation, to be really a nation, has to have its own language. He says they knew that there would one day be a sovereign nation, independent, in the land of Israel, and they taught each other Hebrew. They kept the Hebrew language. So the connection to the past, giving them their yichus, their dignity, and the connection to the future, knowing that we'd be a sovereign nation with our own language, etc. He says that's the idea of Ga'alti Eschem. Right? Ga'alti, I've redeemed you. In other words, given them that dignity. That's exactly the idea that Rav Nosson Finkel is talking about. And of course, we know that throughout the Gemara, there's a huge and important place given for the idea of kavod habrius, the honor of an individual. I mean, sometimes in shocking ways, the Gemara in Bava Metzia talks about the Bava Kama. Sorry, talks about the fact that, you know, the Torah, when someone steals a sheep, he must pay back four times the amount of the sheep. If he's caught, if he sells it and shechts it, four times the amount. If he steals a cow, he pays five times the value. What's the difference? Right? You steal the sheep. Okay, there's a fine. Why is the fine different? So one view in the Gemara is astounding. I mean, both views are astounding. One view is because the thief, if he steals a sheep, the sheep's not going to go. You know, he can't. You know, he has to carry. He carries on his back so he can get out quickly. So he has the ignominy, the indignity of having this sheep on his back with all the filth. A sheep is like toilet trained, you know. Like, so he's got the sheep on his back and he's schlepping the sheep. So the poor guy, so he's already suffered, so you only have to fine him four times the value. With a cow, you obviously can't carry a cow on your back, right? So the cow walks along, so he didn't suffer the indignity of carrying a cow on his back, and so therefore, he's given a fine of five times. Others say, because you know what? When he carried the sheep, he was doing malacha. He did something. He did work. He worked a bit. There's some earning value there. Amazing. So, but they both, I think, the same idea. And the Maharal, by the way, points out, the Maharal says, what do you mean? Reb Meir tells us that the reason he pays four times for the sheep, which is less than for the cow, is because the sheep, there was indignity, nitbazeh. He becomes, his honor is abused, He says, but he's a thief. He did it in private. No one saw this. What do you mean, his honor? No one saw this. He's a thief. He snuck out with the sheep on his back. So where is the lack? So listen to what the Maharal says. Afagav she'ein adam ro'ehu lezeh haganav. No one sees this thief. No one sees this thief mitbazeh being degraded. Mikol makom nitbazeh klapei atzmo. In his own eyes, he's degraded. That's sufficient reason for the Torah not to give him as much of a fine as the guy who steals the cow. Incredible. So that's how, so Rav Nosson Sis Finkel saw in so many places in Chazal this idea. And the final source I want to bring is something which is actually post Slobodka, but this has its origins in Volozhin, Rav Avraham Yitzhak HaKohen Cook. So that Rav Cook has a wonderful, not that well known, but a sefer on of explanations of the Agarata in Shas called Ein Ayo. So in Ein Ayo, in Shabbos, he talks about the following. You know, there's we have many maisras. You have to give truma maisra. You have to give tithes of your crops. You have to give zroa v'lachayim v'akeva, parts of the animal have to go to the kohen. Reishis ageis, you have to give some of the wool to the kohen. You have to do the whole bunch of things. You have to give to the kohen, to the levi, to the poor, to the beis hamikdash, etc., etc. We all know that. There's one which is a very strange one. It's Maiser Sheni. What do you do with Maiser Sheni? Maiser Sheni, you take the tithe from your crop, from your fruits and your vegetables, etc. What do you do with it? Take it to Yerushalayim. Who do you give it to? Yourself. This sounds like a scam, doesn't it? Oh, yes. I'm a tax-exempt organization, so I can actually donate to my own foundation. What? Who am I? I'm giving tithes to me. That's awesome, isn't it? That's great. Give tithes to yourself. Right? Yes, I gave my Maiser 10% of my income. To whom? To me. Well, I'm not deserving it. I'm a levy. Right? I'll show you. So is that weird? So Rav Cook says, what are you doing? You're giving Maiser to yourself. So listen to Rav Cook's answer. And it was on the sheet, but he says it so beautifully. He says this. He says the purpose here is to indicate, to teach every single one of us that we too are Kohanim. Every Jew is a Kohen. Mamleches Kohanim v'goy kadosh. A nation of Kohanim, of priests, and a holy nation. He says, how do you remind yourself that you're a Kohen? He says, give yourself Maiser every couple of years. And don't just eat it at home. Take it to Yerushalayim as though you're a Kohen. Eat it with Kedusha and Tahara in purity and holiness in Yerushalayim. He says, then you'll really understand, yeah, I'm a Kohen. And he says, actually, that's one of the ideas behind the lighting of the menorah. Every Jewish home, we don't just light a menorah in the public square, right? First of all, that's prohibited in the United States, right? Whatever, right? But you don't light a menorah. That's not the mitzvah. In fact, there's a whole machloikas as to whether even in lighting a menorah in shul, right, whether there is a mitzvah to do so or not. Is it pure semei nisa? Or is it just a minhag, zecher, to the base of Migdash, and there are halachic ramifications, which one you hold? Do you have to do it with a minion? Rav Soloveitchik used to always be very careful that the lighting of the menorah in the shul should be specifically between mincha and mariv, when there was a minion gathered for mincha and a minion gathered for mariv, and it was in between. He says, otherwise it's not really done in a communal fashion. So he was very strict about that. But the truth of the matter is, it's quite questionable is it a chiyuv or is it just a zayin. But where is the true obligation to light a menorah? Not in the Beis HaMikdash, but actually in your home. Because every Jewish home is a Beis HaMikdash. Every Jewish family, we are Kohanim. So Rav Cook is explaining that, and the example he finds is Maiser Sheni, which is just an amazing explanation for Maiser Sheni, which fits in so beautifully with the way the Alter Sobotka understood things. So that's how he understands it. He says that really, our attitude to all of Judaism, attitude to the mitzvahs, attitude to the Torah is there really are expressions that we avoid averus because beneath our dignity. We do mitzvahs because it's appropriate for me to be acting in this way. And that is how he That's how he was able to produce people like Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg and Rav Yaakov Yitzhak Ruderman and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rav Aaron Kotler and Rav Shachem Sarah and so on and so forth. People who understood how important it was. Just, I'll give you a political example. I heard a lecture from Rav Aaron Rakef at Rothkopf about the foundations of Shas, the Sephardi party. You know who was responsible for founding Shas? Anyone know? Shas was the Sephardi political party in Israel. Who was responsible for founding it? Anyone have any idea? No. Rav Shach from Ponovich, student of Slobodka, because he understood, he felt, he saw that so many Sfarim in Israel lacked the appropriate amount of self-respect that they needed, because they'd been pushed down by the political system and so on and so forth. He said they have their own political party. There'll be, and he was right. It raised the whole consciousness and the esteem of Sfaradim Israel was just like shot up 100-fold when they had that. I don't agree with their policies, but that's not the point. The point is that here was a Slobodka student recognized the need for COVID, recognized that need. And it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. Right? When COVID runs out of control, then it's bad. But the idea that we have to work on that, we have to understand that, and that's how we have to educate our children, ourselves and our students, that don't avoid our virus because it's osser. Don't avoid our virus because it's going to get punished. Avoid them because they're beneath our dignity. Happy is the person who is above his sins, and his sins are not above him. That is the lesson of the Ultra Slobodka, and that's where he saw it in Chazal and the Rishonim. And hopefully we'll be able to all be elevated and feel a little bit of that covet of ourselves and the covet of Klal Yisrael, and we should be zoicha to see that one day we'll be able to all really take our Maisa Sheni to go to Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, eat it there, b'kedusha, uv'tahara, b'mherav yameinu. Amen.
Thank you very much to Rebecca for enlightening us and honoring us with your inspiring words.
Thank you.
We're going to dive Maariv in a few minutes, but if you want to...
It's fine. I'll take questions, heckling, alternate speeches, insults, political statements, endorsements. No? Okay, fine. Do you have a chiyuv here?